Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Nearly every day that the Senate's been in session for the past 2 years, I've come down to this very spot and said that Democrats were ignoring the wishes of the American people. When it comes to earmarks, I won't be guilty of the same thing.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell now 0-2 in direct confrontations with the Tea Party. Their candidate beat his candidate for U.S. Senate from his state of Kentucky. Their candidate is Senator-elect Rand Paul. And now they have won the battle for his endorsement of a top Tea Party policy priority, a ban on earmarks. McConnell opposed the ban because he brings home so much bacon for the bluegrass state, and on separation of powers grounds.
I'm not wild about turning over more spending authority to the executive branch, but I've come to share the view of most Americans that our nation is at a crossroads, that we will not be able to secure the kind of future we want for our children and grandchildren unless we act, and act quickly.
The Washington Post today, by the way, calls McConnell a master of purveying pork for his home state of Kentucky. His total career earmark procurement for Kentucky is approaching $1 billion, according to the watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense, as cited by the Post. So let's talk about that, the coming leadership votes in the House and Senate, and the next step in the Charles Rangel ethics charges with Time Magazine congressional correspondent Jay Newton Small to begin the program today. Hi, Jay. Thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Hey, Brian. Thanks so much for having me on.
Can we start by stepping back and reminding everyone, what is an earmark?
Sure. And before I start, I just want to apologize. I'm actually in the Senate Periodical Press Gallery, so you're going to hear a little background noise as the other journalists go about their work. But essentially, an earmark is when members of Congress request pet projects in their neighborhoods. Now, this can be in their congressional districts. Now, this can be anything from a playground that they feel is very needed by, you know, school district, to a highway. If you go to West Virginia, for example, Route 29 for much of the state is called the Robert C. Byrd Highway, named after Senator Byrd. This could be to an airport, in fact, Ted Stevens International Airport in Anchorage, Alaska, that was totally renovated with an earmark from Ted Stevens. So it basically is local needs translated to members, by their constituents lobbying them, and they go out and they get these earmarks inserted into the budget.
But it's not just horse trading among members of Congress, if I'm not mistaken. Like, I'll vote for your pork if you vote for mine. Isn't it money that gets appropriated to your home district without any vote at all?
It is, actually. In many ways, members submit lists to the Appropriations Committee and say, I would like this, this, that, that, and that. And they'll come back and say, you can have this and this, but not that and that. And essentially just get sort of added into the appropriations bills as they go along within the Appropriations Committee before they go through the committee process of, voting it out. And so there's no way to sort of break out these earmarks and vote on them individually, as many members in Congress have been trying to do who oppose earmarks. Jeff Flake, for example, in the House for years, has picked out what he considers the most egregious earmarks, sort of money for the, collection of Kentucky stamps. I'm making this up at this point, but, just really outrageous things that they feel should not be, Congress should not be spending money on and the government shouldn't be spending money on. And he forces votes on the House floor every year on these things to embarrass these earmarkers, to say this is, just porking, essentially.
Let's take some phone calls on this, too. Listeners, if you're a Tea Party movement supporter and you have made this your number one or two priority for the new Congress, call us up and tell us why. Why earmarks? It's not that much of the federal budget, so it's not going to really fix the deficit problem all that much or knock down taxes. Probably in any way that you could draw a straight line to. Why is this on the top of the Tea Party movement's agenda? If you're a member of the Tea Party movement or anyone else who feels strongly that earmarks should be banned by Congress, call us up or anyone on the other side of the question. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Jay Newton Small, who covers Congress for Time Magazine. And you can post your comments to our politics website, WNYC.org. Click on It's a Free Country or just go to itsafreecountry.org. You would agree, Jay, with the Washington Post characterization of Mitch McConnell as a master of purveying pork?
I would agree that he is one of the masters of purveying pork. Like, I mean, there are people, Robert Byrd, for example, the late Robert Byrd, who died last year, said that it was his goal to bring in more than $1 billion worth of earmarks to his state of West Virginia. And in his more than 50 years in the Senate, he, I think, more than tripled that. So there are some people who are really and truly the master artists at porking. But in terms of Mitch McConnell also makes an argument that, look, you know, this is part of what Congress is mandated to do by the Constitution, and that is to represent their local district spending needs in Congress. And if you give up this right, and this is what he's argued for many years, then you're essentially ceding the right to the administration. You're giving that power to the executive office. And in fact, a lot of Democratic members now can actually go to the administration and say, here are the earmarks I need. Can you please fold it into the budget, which then gets folded into the administration's request before it even goes to Congress. So we don't even know what those earmarks are anymore.
So what does President Obama, the leader of the executive branch, say about this issue himself?
Well, and he's always been for earmark reform. Even when he was back in the Senate, he actually authored a bill, led negotiations on ethics reform, and has always said that earmarks have been a problem. Now, is he for a moratorium on them? He's often said that he would like to see the practice end. But I think he's also sensitive to the fact that a lot of members of his own party like earmarks, that they, you know, much like Mitch McConnell is sensitive to the fact that much of the Senate indeed really does like earmarks. So I think that there's a hedging that goes on both sides with leaders of the parties. When you're saying we want to get rid of them, yes, it's something that's very popular with the people, but keep in mind, like you said, it's a tiny percentage of the budget. We're talking about discretionary spending already is only, I think, 7% of the overall budget, and the earmarks are less than 1% of that. So in comparison to say, I mean, it's never going to fix the deficit problem here. I mean, the deficit problem needs to be addressed through massive spending, cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and entitlements. This is just a little drop in the bucket, but it's hugely symbolic, and it has been since the Bridge to Nowhere when Ted Stevens tried to build that multi-million-dollar bridge to an island that had 7,000 people on it, and it caused this enormous uproar. The conservatives have always, you know, have really championed this as a symbolic gesture of cutting the pork.
And, of course, there were people on the other side of that who said that wasn't a bridge to nowhere. That was a bridge to somewhere where 7,000 people were extremely isolated in part of Alaska. But that was an argument for another time. David in Toms River, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. The thing is, it's not only bankrupting our children and our grandchildren, it affects us directly because people think that we may end up like Greece or Portugal or one of these other countries. Then they don't want to invest. They do not want to hire. People do not want to work hard. If the whole economy, if the people are afraid the whole economy is heading for bankruptcy, then they have no confidence in the economy, and you just don't want to invest in it.
So, but if the earmarks are a tiny bit of the economy, a tiny bit of the federal budget, then how does that lead to that slippery slope, that avalanche of lack of confidence that you were just describing?
It's a general attitude that goes on in Washington, and it is expensive, and it leads to all kinds of other spending, bailouts and all kinds of other things, which excessive spending and no-bid contracts and programs that are not necessary, and it just creates a whole atmosphere that people just don't like. And if you don't like the atmosphere, why invest in an economy that you just don't think is worth anything?
David, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. William in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, William.
Good morning. One of the unintended aspects of earmarks, which I think your guest, who otherwise hit all the other points to be had in the discussion, is in point of fact that earmarks, historically speaking, have been a disguised subsidy from the wealthier parts of the country to the poorer parts. Most of the famous senatorial or congressional generators of earmarks tend to come from poorer sections of the country. A famous one your guest just cited was West Virginia. West Virginia vis-a-vis New York, New Jersey, Connecticut has a much lower per capita income. And the odd thing is, or if you like, the ironic thing is that most of the Tea Party enthusiasts will, in point of fact, be the ones to suffer the most because, in point of fact, they need these disguised subsidies more than, say, I, as a Manhattanite, do.
Right. William, this is a fascinating point and really a larger issue that goes beyond earmarks. So, J. Newton Small, let's linger on this for just a minute. It is true that a lot of federal spending is redistribution, to use a dirty word, of money from people who have more to people who have less. And when you look at that on a regional basis or a state-by-state basis, it's definitely a transfer of wealth from states like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut to states like Kentucky, Georgia, and West Virginia, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on the other hand, some of the most famous porkers have been from fairly industrialized states. Look at Jack Murtha, for example, the late Jack Murtha. He was a congressman. He was head of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee for decades. And he really brought home the bacon home to Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is not necessarily a very poor rural state.
But to finish the political thought, which I think William was making, it's those states in the southern poorer part of the country that tend to be the most against federal taxes and federal spending as a matter of philosophy, which in a way doesn't make sense because they're the recipients. We are the payers.
No, absolutely. And in this case, I was in Alaska recently for the senatorial race there, and I think part of the reason that it looks like Lisa Murkowski is going to win is that there was this panic in the state of Alaska, which is the most heavily subsidized state by the federal government in the union. And so many institutions depend on subsidies from the federal government that there was just this panic of the unions and of the government and of the native tribes that they weren't going to get any more subsidies if Joe Miller was elected to the Senate because he is a small government Republican. And I think that that's what pushed this massive write-in candidacy for Lisa Murkowski, because she's on the Appropriations Committee, she does her job, she brings home the pork in Alaska, and there people in Alaska were very worried about this. And so there is this kind of, dichotomy between, wanting a small government, but then depending hugely on a small government.
Lucille in Hazlitt, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lucille.
Yes, this is like a non-issue. Earmarks are not part of the budget. The budget is the budget. If $10 million is set aside for a particular agency or a particular area, whether they're earmarked or not, the $10 million is still going to be spent. So it's really a public relations ploy by the Republicans, by the Tea Party, for that matter, to pretend that they're cutting the budget by getting rid of earmarks when the same amount of money is going to be spent.
Interesting point. Is that accurate? Is that accurate in monetary terms?
Earmarks do actually add to, the budget, the underlying budget resolution that is passed by the budget committees is separate and independent from the individual appropriations bills that are passed by the appropriations committee. That's why it's a different process. And I agree that earmarks are not in the budget, but they are in the appropriations bills, and they are money that's added to the appropriations bills that did not exist in the budget that is then spent. In some cases, yes, this is, let's say, a fund that's going to the EPA to, for $10 million this year to clean up, asbestos or something. I mean, this is all just for example, but in some cases, what the earmark will do is redirect some of that money, let's say $2 million, to a study on how asbestos can best be cleaned up. And it just so happens that study is conducted by a university in a certain member's home district. So in some cases, yes, it's not adding to the budget, but in other cases, it definitely does.
Lucille, did you tell our screener that even though it's a non-issue for you in the way that you describe, that you're still against earmarks?
Well, I'm against earmarks because I think that they're they lead to an abuse of power. You look at Mitch McConnell, and it's like, here's a power broker that is, sending money to Kentucky that I'm sending to Washington. Like, I feel I need to pay my fair share of taxes, but I think I should get it back in my state when I'm paying. Why should everybody in Alaska get a couple $1,000 rebate every year of my tax money?
Thank you. And that's really what this is about for the Tea Party movement supporters, isn't it, Jay? Or wouldn't you describe it that way? That they see the whole spending system in Congress as so corrupt, whether, not illegally corrupt, unfortunately, they would say, but as so corrupt, you wash my hands, I'll wash yours, scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, that it leads to all this additional spending, and it looks like makes Congress look like the swamp that people have described it as. Is that really the bottom line here for why this has risen to such a political priority when not that much money is at stake?
No, absolutely. I mean, it is a culture of porking that they object to, that they're upset with. And to be fair, up until the Bridge to Nowhere, the whole culture of earmarking was incredibly corrupted. I mean, you had members who were creating earmarks that created centers in their districts, and the only thing that center did was train small businesses and train constituents on how to request more earmarks. So it was sort of like, you know, centers for earmarking. It's just earmarked centers for earmarking. It was just this crazy kind of almost pyramid scheme, but going the other way. That was really kind of out of control. And I think that culture has been severely reined in the years since, and now obviously it looks like going to be completely thrown out because it's caused such outrage.
By the way, where does Harry Reid stand on this? Because it's the Democrats who still control the Senate, so McConnell can't whip this new position into law, right?
No, and in fact, Harry Reid himself is a very prodigious porker. He brings in more federal money to Nevada than the entire rest of the Nevada federal members combined, essentially. But I think personally, Harry Reid is very supportive of earmarks. Whether or not he's going to go along with the ban, there's obviously a lot of political pressure to do so, both from the president and from the Republican side, because if Republicans are seen to be giving this up and they're not going to request earmarks anymore, then it's the Democrats who become the problem, the porker, the big spenders, and that just feeds into the meme that's been going on of the Democrats or the big government socialists, you know, things like that. So I think there'll be a lot of pressure for Harry Reid to make a similar announcement.
Jay Newton Small with us, congressional correspondent for Time Magazine, for another couple of minutes, and then we will talk about the Kathy Black waiver process to become the school's chancellor of New York City compared to the Joel Klein waiver process. He needed one, too, in 2002, and we'll talk to a New York Times correspondent whose article yesterday seems to say that all the arguments made for Joel Klein in 2002 may backfire on Kathy Black right now. So we'll see about that coming right up. But I want to touch two other things, the Rangel hearings and the leadership, the Democratic leadership of the Congress particularly. And things are moving pretty fast as Congress reorganizes itself after the election. And I see that New York Senator Chuck Schumer has a newly created Democratic leadership position, something involving partisan messaging and a rapid response team. Do you know about this yet?
I've heard that it was in the works, but it doesn't surprise me since, I mean, Schumer is a master messenger and he's very good at spinning. So he's always one of my first people that I like to go to for a quick quote because he's very quick on the turnaround, and all of his spokesmen are extremely fast at putting out statements. He's always the first office to put out a statement when almost anything happens. So that really wouldn't surprise me, and I think Democrats have realized, you know, in the last, you know, the last elections where they lost a lot of seats, that they're having a problem with messaging, and they need to be able to sell their agenda better to the American people. Otherwise, they could potentially lose the Senate and the White House in the next election.
So Schumer's going to get that position, presumably, and Harry Reid will be voted back in as majority leader by the Democrats, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, the leadership elections start in 6 minutes downstairs, one floor below where I am right now.
And so that's not going to be close. What about Nancy Pelosi's bid to remain as head of the Democrats when they become the minority in the House? When does that vote come?
That's actually tomorrow. And I think that's interesting because, she's got a much smaller caucus, and the caucus is much more liberal at this point, and she's very popular with the progressives. So I don't think that she'll definitely get back in and get reelected. But there are the remaining moderates are extremely upset with her. Heath Shuler, who's a congressman from North Carolina, said that he's challenging her. He knows he can't win, but he just wants to make a symbolic challenge because somebody should be angry that she lost 66 seats. And there's a whole bunch of amendments that are happening, you know, that are being offered by the remaining blue dogs, the moderates in the Democratic caucus, saying that Pelosi, you know, should be stripped of the power of doing the Rules Committee, of doing of controlling the Rules Committee, of controlling committee assignments, that these things should be voted on by the caucus as a whole. And so there's certainly going to be repercussions for her. It's not going to be as easy of a conference to lead anymore because of the losses.
And let's move on to the Charles Rangel House Ethics Committee hearing. After yesterday's proceedings, the prosecutor, the chief counsel of the Ethics Committee, Blake Chisholm, serving in effect as the prosecutor, came to this conclusion.
There are no genuine issues as to any material facts in this case. As a result, the case is ripe for decision.
What does that mean, there are no genuine issues as to any material facts in the case? Is it that Rangel isn't disputing the basic facts?
Well, I mean, Rangel essentially isn't even getting to the point where he's disputing what happened. He's yesterday he sort of came in and said that he's been treated completely unfairly, that he wasn't given a chance for legal representation. Meanwhile, this trial's been going on and off for the last 2 years, essentially. What happened is that he fired his legal team over the past summer, because he'd already spent more than $2 million on his defense, and they told him that the trial itself would cost another $1 million, and he said he can't afford it. He needs more time to raise money in order to pay for these legal fees, and that he isn't being afforded due process because he can't afford a lawyer at this point, to which Zoe Lofgren said, look, you've known this was going to happen for months and months, and to be fair, the subcommittee felt that he really dragged his feet, just tried to sort of drag out the whole process, hoping it would go away. Now, having spent so much time dragging their feet and handing over any kind of evidentiary information, like suddenly he finds himself, you know, out of funds and with nobody, no lawyers in his final stand-up, in his final hearing. So, I mean, he basically said, I can't represent myself here. This is ridiculous, and stormed out. So there's no more, you can't have a trial with nobody on trial. So that now they're just sort of entering the decision phase.
Well, here's Rangel in the summer asking to be tried right then on the House floor when Congress decided to wait until now.
If it is the judgment of people here, for whatever reason, that I resign, then heck, have the Ethics Committee expedite this. Don't leave me swinging in the wind until November.
But here is yesterday, November 15th, when that day finally came.
I object to the proceeding, and I, with all due respect, since I don't have counsel to advise me, I'm going to have to excuse myself.
So what's the feeling in that press room that you're in about Rangel's walkout yesterday? Victim of financial circumstances, as he says, or planned all along as a strategy?
I don't know if it was planned all along as a strategy. I think this kind of thing where he boxed himself in, you know, and his lawyers said for such a long time during the whole sort of subcommittee trial that you need to drag your feet, drag out this process, and if you can drag it out long enough, it'll just kind of go away. He believed them. They dragged out the process for such a long time. It cost millions of dollars to do, and now he's sort of, you know, now they're sort of like, well, great, we're having the hearing, we've gone through this whole process, and you're going to be tried in a sort of court of your peers, and he has nobody to represent him anymore because he can't afford it. He really dug his own grave in this, and you know, it's sort of the kind of thing where he's fighting for his reputation in his life, but he's really got to realize that there's no way he's ever going to get back the gavel to Ways and Means, that's kind of over, and he's 80 years old, you know, he needs to... This is the end of his career, essentially.
Well,
he's going to get reprimanded by the House, most likely.
Reprimanded, and then he stays in and does his work, presumably because he was reelected quite easily in his home district in Manhattan. But that was a House Ethics Subcommittee that heard the case yesterday. Now the full committee will have to vote on whether to refer the case to the full House, which would then vote on what punishment?
No, the House Ethics Subcommittee has already heard all the evidence, heard, you know, Rangel's defense, and then they were the ones that said, we believe that there's been 13 violations of House laws, and they were the ones that recommended a full hearing, a full trial of the committee, the Standards and Operating Conduct Committee, which is what you saw yesterday morning. Now, they will then come to a recommendation. Most likely, most people seem to think that the recommendation will be that a formal censure of the House. They'll recommend that to the full House, and then the full House will vote on it.
Oh, I just want to take one call, even though we're over time, because we don't get a lot of calls from Portland, Maine at all, and certainly not a lot on Charlie Rangel. So, Joe in Portland, Maine, hello, you're on WNYC. How do you know our station?
Hey, Brian, thanks. I'll be real quick. I just want to say I was never a fan of Charlie Rangel, but I'm so impressed by his chutzpah that he's really won me over. I just want to say also he's like Odysseus from Homer, who always had a trick up his sleeve and came home at the end dressed as a beggar for the grand finale, and he's really just knocked me out with all this.
Well, all right, Joe, we will see what happens. The subcommittee concluded that the facts are not in dispute about Rangel not paying taxes on income from property in the Dominican Republic, having a second rent-stabilized apartment in Harlem that he used as a campaign office, and soliciting money for his City College charity from people doing business before his committee. So what's the timeline? When do you expect the full House to get this?
Well, they had expected to do this entire week's worth of hearing, but since they are not having a trial and he's refusing to stand trial and answer formally the charges in public, then they essentially can move directly to the punishment phase and what they decide to recommend to the full House. I think that that decision could come before the end of the week, if not sooner.
Jay Newton-Small, congressional correspondent for Time Magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And again, you can weigh in on earmarks or Charlie Rangel on our politics website. It's freecountry.org. And next, we're going to talk about the Kathy Black waiver application to become school's chancellor of New York City compared to the Joel Klein waiver application of 2002. How are they similar? And we will learn that they're very different. Stay with us.